Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Shireen Al-Adaimi, Assistant Professor of Education at Michigan State University, who discusses the current Saudi-led attack on Yemen's port city of Hodeidah in a nation gripped by famine and disease. Timothy Carr, the media democracy group Free Press, who takes a critical look at what the AT&T-Time Warner merger will mean for consumers and citizens. And Carol Bubar Blodgett, also known as Spirit Hawk, who talks about her 8th annual Water is Life Walk, where she hiked the length of the Housatonic River from western Massachusetts to the river's mouth on the Connecticut coast of Long Island Sound. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Three years ago, Chinese authorities in the western province of Xinjiang, with a large Muslim population known as Uyghurs, ordered everyone in the provincial capital, Urumqi, to return to the towns in which they were born to get a new identity card. This order imposed hardships on families who had migrated to the capital city to find work. Uyghur militancy has taken a violent turn in recent years. In 2013, a Uyghur driver crashed a car into pedestrians in Tiananmen Square. In 2014, a knife-wielding Uyghur gang slaughtered 31 travelers at a train station in the city of Kunming in Yunnan Province. Chinese and Syrian officials say 1,500 Uyghurs have fought in Syria with the Islamic State or the Al-Qaeda-affiliated group Jabhat Nusra. Today, there are 73 re-education camps for Uyghurs in Xinjiang, according to German researcher Adrian Zenz. In the largest Uyghur city, Kashgar, 120,000 people are held in re-education camps. The Chinese government argues that harsh measures are needed to prevent violence associated with Uyghur separatism and conflict with ethnic Han Chinese. Also, Xinjiang is now China's largest producer of domestic oil and gas, and much of the fossil fuels imported from Central Asia and Russia are transported through this region. The conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Ohio's aggressive voter purge law, which allows voters to be scrubbed from the registration rolls if they miss two consecutive federal elections. Only a handful of states have such punitive voting regulations, which disproportionately impact poor people and communities of color. The case was brought by plaintiff Larry Harmon, a software engineer who couldn't vote during the 2015 ballot initiative on legalizing marijuana. In accordance with Ohio law, his name was removed from the rolls because he hadn't voted in two consecutive elections, nor had he sent back a postcard the state had sent him to confirm that his address had not changed. A federal court of appeals in Cincinnati ruled in favor of Harmon, saying the Ohio purge law violated the National Voter Registration Act, commonly known as the Motor Voter Law. But in a 5-4 ruling on June 11th, the conservative majority on the Supreme Court declared Ohio's purge law was constitutional since the state had mailed notices to confirm voter registration addresses. Justice Samuel Alito, in the majority opinion, claimed there were 24 million voter registrations that were invalid or inaccurate. However, in a stinging dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor cited the heavy impact of the law on African Americans. In Cincinnati, 10% of black voters were taken off voter rolls, in contrast to only 4% of voters in the city's white-majority suburbs. The National Fair Housing Alliance recently issued its annual Fair Housing Trends Report. The study found that the number of housing discrimination complaints continues to rise as the Trump administration is rescinding rules that impose strict deadlines on states and localities to address housing discrimination and segregation. In response, the National Fair Housing Alliance and other fair housing advocates have gone to federal court to force the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, to reinstate the federal requirement that local and state governments work to eliminate housing discrimination patterns as a condition of receiving HUD funding. In 2017, 57% of fair housing complaints involved people with disabilities. The second largest category of complaints stemmed from racial bias. The biggest obstacle to a person or family's right to housing, as it turns out, is still the federal government's failure to vigorously enforce existing laws. According to the American Prospect, the Trump Treasury Department recommended repealing fair housing enforcement under the Dodd-Frank banking reform law in the auto lending sector. Meanwhile, Treasury officials also recommended that HUD pull back from decades-long precedent by not applying key provisions of the Fair Housing Act to the insurance industry. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Yemen's vital port city of Hodeidah is under attack by a Saudi Arabia-led military coalition, employing both airstrikes and ground troops from the United Arab Emirates. International aid groups say that the offensive launched last week to drive out Houthi rebels is disrupting the delivery of critical food and medical supplies in a nation already gripped by famine and a cholera epidemic. According to the United Nations, an estimated 10,000 people, two-thirds of them civilians, have been killed and 55,000 others injured in Yemen's three-year civil war. The conflict in Yemen between Shia Houthi rebels and forces loyal to Yemen's president Abdul Rabu Mansour Hadi began in 2014 after rebels seized control of the capital city of Sana'a. Saudi Arabia and allied Gulf nations launched a brutal bombing campaign targeting the Houthis in March 2015. Human rights groups have condemned the nonstop U.S.-supported Saudi airstrikes for repeatedly targeting civilians and civil infrastructure such as schools, hospitals, and markets. Your reporter spoke with Shireen Al-Adami, assistant professor of education at Michigan State University, who's originally from Yemen. Here she discusses the current attack on the port city of Hodeidah, famine, a cholera epidemic, and the role of the U.S. military.
Yemen right now, Scott, is experiencing what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis on Earth. If your listeners remember, at the height of the cholera epidemic in Haiti, there were about 750,000 people who were infected by cholera. In Yemen, the number has already surpassed 1 million people. And, you know, cholera is due to lack of access to clean water. There's essentially, you know, it's very difficult to access clean water in Yemen. Yemen used to even import its water as well as 90% of its food. So people are having trouble accessing water. They're getting sick. And then the remedy for cholera is as simple as, you know, rehydrating with clean water and electrolytes and so on. But again, the health system has been so destroyed that people don't often have access. And a lot of the children who've died because of cholera are, you know, their immune systems are weakened because of hunger and malnutrition. So we're talking 113,000 children who've died due to diseases like cholera and starvation in the years 2016 and 2017 alone. 113,000 children. This is the impact of this war. This is in addition, of course, to the over 44,000 deaths from violent deaths. And this is the newest figure that's been updated from the 10,000 that we've often heard. The country is essentially completely in ruins. The, you know, healthcare system has been destroyed. The education system is barely functioning. Civil society has been destroyed. So it's had a very devastating impact. And this is what happens when you have a coalition of countries and an international community that is attacking the Middle East poorest country.
Shireen, as many of us have been reading, the Saudi-led military coalition is currently launching an assault on the vital Yemeni port of Hodeidah on the Red Sea. As I understand it, this port is the most critical point where food and humanitarian aid enter the country, the little humanitarian aid that does find its way to Yemen. Tell us about this attack and the concern the world has about the consequences for Yemen's civilian population.
So in the past, the Americans, even though they've been very helpful to the Saudis in this war, have drawn a red line when it comes to Hodeidah, because they recognize that if Hodeidah port is attacked, you know, this is where 70% of aid comes into the country, and 80% of the population is reliant on the food and the aid that's coming in through the port of Hodeidah, that if, you know, if it was attacked and the shipments are disrupted in any way, then these 22 million people will essentially starve to death. And so, you know, last week, the UAE decided to lead this offensive on Hodeidah, and they've ignored all sorts of calls by U.S. senators and, you know, U.S. Generals. And unfortunately, as soon as they began attacking on Wednesday, the U.S. jumped to help them by providing airstrike targeting. So again, we've seen that the U.S. is willing to help the Saudi and UAE-led coalition at all costs, even while knowing that this attack essentially is, it's a deliberate use of starvation as a weapon, which we know is a war crime under humanitarian law. You know, right now, there have been 6 days of fighting inside the city. Thousands of people who have the means to flee have fled. Many more people, of course, are not able to flee. The fighting has been intense. We know that there are French special forces on the ground helping the Emiratis and the Saudis, and of course, all sorts of mercenaries from various countries. But this is very disturbing because so many more people are going to be affected if there's any kind of disruption to the aid that's coming in through Hodeidah.
Shireen, I'm certain that there are millions of Americans who know little or nothing about the war in Yemen. Why is this important? Why should Americans care about this conflict so far away?
I think anybody who cares about justice would care about this issue. Again, this is not a call for intervention. This is the very opposite of it. We don't want to spend taxpayer money on creating these conditions. I'm calling for the U.S. to stop its intervention in Yemen, to leave people alone, let it be. This civil war had nothing to do with the United States, and it would have never escalated to this degree had we not been involved in it. So there are so many issues at home that we have to worry about. Why should we spend all this time and energy and commit war crimes to help our allies, Saudi Arabia, when this has nothing to do with us? So I hope that people would care enough about that just to pick up the phone and say, we should not be involved in Yemen.
That was Shireen Al-Adeimi, Assistant Professor of Education at Michigan State University, who's originally from Yemen. Learn more about the ongoing war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Ruling against a Trump Justice Department lawsuit, a federal judge approved the merger between AT&T and Time Warner on June 11th. The $85 billion deal will bring together two of the nation's largest media companies with complementary assets, one that produces content and the other which distributes content. AT&T, the world's largest telecommunications company, will now be joined by Time Warner's TV networks, including HBO, TBS, TNT, CNN, the Cartoon Network, Turner Classic Movies, and the Warner Brothers Movie and Television Studios. There were suspicions that the Justice Department's effort to block the merger was in part motivated by Donald Trump's anger at CNN over the news network's coverage of his presidency, a charge denied by administration officials. There are fears that the new larger AT&T will now use its market power to favor online content and video services it owns, a scenario made more likely by the FCC's recent repeal of net neutrality protections for consumers. Your reporter spoke with Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications with the media democracy group Free Press. Here he takes a critical look at what the AT&T-Time Warner merger will mean for consumers and the danger inherent in the increasing consolidation of media ownership.
Well, this is part of a new wave of media consolidation that really was triggered many years ago when Comcast bought NBC Universal. What we're seeing with Comcast NBC, what we're now seeing with AT&T Time Warner, is a merger of different types of media companies. You have very large distribution companies like Comcast, which has is the largest cable internet provider in the country, and AT&T is not far behind in terms of their internet services. They're buying up content properties. NBC Universal has a number of television and cable stations, movie production studios, and the like. The same is true with many regards with Time Warner, which owns HBO and CNN. So you have distribution companies taking over content creation companies, content production companies, and creating what are called massive vertically integrated media companies that control distribution as well as creation of content. And there are a number of reasons to be concerned about that. Primarily, one of the concerns that Free Press has is that these companies, now that they control distribution via our high-speed internet and content creation, have even more of an inclination to prioritize information over the internet, to violate what's called net neutrality, the principle that allows internet users to choose what they want to watch and where they want to go online. That rule was done away by the Trump administration, and these companies are now merging in this way that will allow them to push certain types of content and services over their high-speed internet connections, and conversely, to slow down or block your ability to access other services that they may not own.
Tim, I wanted to ask you about the issue of political speech. There's certainly a lot of concern about the control these larger and larger companies have over consumer pricing. But as citizens, we're concerned about access to dissenting points of view or points of view that don't quite match up with the corporate view of the world. What is the concern about political speech here, if any?
Looking over the last couple of years, you have to understand how important the internet has become as an organizing tool for social justice, racial justice movement. A movement like Black Lives Matter relied very heavily on the internet in order to get their message out. When there was an uprising in Ferguson in the wake of a police shooting there, the mainstream media was not paying a lot of attention to what was happening on the streets there. But people who were in racial justice movements, people who were on the streets there, were very effectively using online tools to get their message out, to get around mainstream news coverage, to an extent that it became so large in social networks and in alternative online media that the mainstream media could no longer ignore it. So an open internet is the reason that they were successful. If we have a scenario, which we do have now, again, the net neutrality rules that we had in place were repealed and taken away on June 11th of this year, where a company, internet access provider, who doesn't like your political message could block access to those websites without any real recourse under the law. We have lost the legal protection that would prevent these large internet service providers from blocking access to content. So I think there's reason to be very concerned, not only on the economic front, as you mentioned, the cost to consumers, but also potentially the stifling of political speech, the stifling of political organizing, making it more and more difficult for people to use the open internet as a tool for organizing.
I've recently read that we're down to about six major companies that dominate all sectors of the media industry. And maybe you can express to us if there's any hope that this trend of media consolidation can be reversed or at least slowed down.
Well, I mean, we once relied upon the Federal Communications Commission to oversee media consolidation, to try to limit it. What we're seeing is a point where we may need to look not so much at the FCC, but at the FTC, the Department of Justice, and see whether there's a case to be made for antitrust. Are these companies getting so powerful and so monopoly-minded that it would trigger antitrust concerns, so that a company like a Google or a Facebook might need to be broken up because it's amassed so much? I mean, obviously, we also should look at things like AT&T and what it's trying to do and what Comcast is trying to do in consolidating. So there is mechanisms to push back against this type of consolidation. At the moment, we're fighting a lot of these types of mergers at the FCC, but we've also, you know, they're also the Department of Justice. So you're seeing a moment where a lot of these companies feel like they have an opportunity. I mean, who knows how long President Trump and his administration will be around, that we need to seize the moment. Comcast is pushing for to buy Fox Television. So we're seeing a lot of merger business happening during this administration. So one of the things that could change this wave of media consolidation is a new administration that is less open to letting very large and powerful corporations have their way.
That was Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications with the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about the efforts to democratize U.S. media by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From mid-May to mid-June, an indigenous woman completed her eighth Water is Life walk from the source of the Housatonic River in western Massachusetts to the river's mouth in Stratford, Connecticut, at Long Island Sound. Carol Buber-Blodgett, who goes by the name of Spirit Hawk, translated from Lakota, traces her matriarchal lineage through the Penobscot Nation and belongs to the defined out-of-existence band of the Penobscot people. She says, like many who have been assimilated, it's very difficult to prove lineage when you're trying to hide your children from boarding school and you try to hide their heritage in order to do that. Spirit Hawk is an adopted Lakota from the Sikonju band and follows the Lakota Sundance way of life. On her hike, Buber-Blodgett stopped at many places along the river, including dams, which she says have heavily damaged the riverine ecosystem, where she said prayers and fed the river with handfuls of wild rice, cornmeal, cranberries, and tobacco, each signifying a staple of indigenous culture. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in the walk for 3 days through northwest Connecticut, in the hills of the Berkshires, where signs were posted everywhere not to eat the fish or even step in the water due to contamination by PCBs dumped years ago into the water by General Electric from its plant in Pittsfield near the source of the Housatonic. What follows is an excerpt from a longer interview with Buber-Blodgett conducted on the banks of the Housatonic River.
The shortest river I've done was the Quinebaug River, and that's the watershed that my grandchildren and I live in.
And that's in what state?
Connecticut and Massachusetts. And so it's a 72-mile river with 18 dams. Dams are very destructive to our waterways because they obstruct the flow, the natural flow of water. The cleansing process of the water, the way the water cycle works, is everything flows to the ocean. Deep within the ocean are places where that water is sucked down under and kept underground for years and years and years before it comes up through our aquifer, up through our artesian wells and our springs. So we can't have healthy rivers. So to make that a little bit easier to understand, if the doctor told you you had 18 clots in your left leg, but don't worry, they've been there a long time, I don't think there's many people who would be very excited about the fact that they had 18 clots in their leg. And it's the same thing. These rivers are the blood veins of Mother Earth. And so we need to see her as a living being, and that those waters flow through her the same way our blood flows through us. And so she can't be healthy if we continue to obstruct the flow of her waters. And then the longest I did was the Cheyenne River, probably physically the most difficult walk. Absolutely beautiful, but challenging, physically challenging because of the terrain.
In the few days that I've spent with you, I would say the one lesson that I've gotten loud and clear is unity. And you've talked about this in different ways a lot of times. And I'd like you to just talk about, you know, what you see as some of the problems and what you see as maybe the solution.
First and foremost, over the 7 years of me walking the water, it has become very clear to me that the real problem with our water is not all the companies dumping things in the river. It's not all the runoff from the agricultural departments. It's not the sewer treatment plants right along the side of the river that when you get a heavy rainfall, the ponds will fill up and it just spills into the water. All of those things contribute, but the real problem is our lack of connection to the water. We have forgotten that water is our source of life. We see it only as a resource now to be bought and sold. And we think nothing of going in and buying a bottle of water any more than we would think to go and buy a bottle of milk. water is our source of life. Without it, we can't live. And we need to pick up that understanding that it's our source again. When we do that, water is trying to teach us so many lessons, but the number one lesson that it's trying to teach us is to come together. If you go to a confluence and you see the two rivers coming together, mingling together, they're not fighting over, this is my territory, that's your territory. They just come together and they just start to meld together right along the edge and just blend together. There's no get over, this is my space, which is what we see in our everyday life here. If I take a glass of water and I pour a few drops of my glass of water into your glass of water, there's no way that you can tell me what was your water and I can tell you what was my water. And water just comes together and it's instantly one. It moves and flows as one. That's what we as a human family need to learn to do. We need to erase the lines that we use to separate ourselves. This is all faith, all people, one prayer for our water. It doesn't matter what religion you are or that you're no religion. It doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are, what sex you are, what color you are. Trees are trees. They come in many different sizes and shapes. End of the day, a tree is a tree. End of the day, we're all a human family. We're all human beings. That's it. We need to come back as one human family. And then we can get the rhythm of the earth back where she needs to be and live in harmony with her. And until we do begin to live in harmony with her, we're just going to suffer more and more from the increased storms and the severity of these storms, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes. We just have to find the balance again. And water is life, but it's even more than that. We are the water, and the water is us. It birthed us, and so honor that source from where you came. It's going to give and give and give. It even gives to the ones who pollute it the most. It never holds back its love, and so give it the love that it gives you.
That was Carol Boober Blodgett, an Indigenous woman who's undertaken 8 sacred water walks to reconnect with our source. Learn more about the sacred water walks by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WLSL in St. Leo, Florida, KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.